Okay, so we are going to continue the discussion of reinforcement learning, and so last time we basically talked about what is RDP, what is reinforcement learning, and we looked at two methods. One is basically direct estimation. In the case of passive learning, basically assuming that we know, their policy is being followed and you want to find out the value of states with respect to that policy. That's the only thing that you need to find out if you already are following a policy. And then we looked at the Monte Carlo based estimation. Remember that what Monte Carlo does is you do an entire trace. Okay, it could be infinitely long or it might just die after reaching a certain goal, terminal state. And then in Monte Carlo, what you're doing, you have to remember that the way you compute the value of a trace is completely by adding up the rewards that you experience, aggregating the reward, which is exactly how we defined the value of a policy. Okay? If it's discounted, then you do discounting. Otherwise, you just add them up. Okay? So in Monte Carlo, you only count the rewards that you actually experience. Okay? And then, then basically this way, as you get number of traces, you would be able to, you would be able to compute the current average of a value of a state. Okay. Now, here is a little tricky thing, actually. Remember back in 471, we talked about something called episodic versus non-episodic. Of all the things, that is something that we don't talk about all that much. We talked about dynamic versus static, we talked about stochastic versus deterministic, partially observable versus fully observable. There was this one little thing that we talked about called episodic versus non-episodic. Okay, what is episodic versus non-episodic? You guys remember? An environment is considered episodic if
you do a bunch of actions at the end of it you have some reward.
Not just that. An episodic means the episode ends.
Yeah.
Right? It's just read the word. An episodic means a TV episode ends. Your life, in the other hand, ends but once. Okay? Our lives are episodic or non-episodic? They're non-episodic. Okay, so in the case of episodic, basically you can always start from scratch. You can reset. Okay, in the way I wrote this Monte Carlo thing, I'm acting as if I can reset. Do you understand what I'm saying? So it's like I get to this state and it's a terminal state. So you have to ask yourself this question. There was something that I was just pushing under the rug. Okay, so remember, this is not simulation anymore. You're not thinking in the head. You are acting in the world. If you are acting in the world and you went there and you died, then how come you have one more trace? Right? Right? We don't get to try. It's not like, what's that movie? Come on. The episodic life movie. Groundhog Day. Groundhog Day. Life is not Groundhog Day. Okay? Groundhog Day, the guy gets to relive his one day so many times so that he can use Monte Carlo to figure out, what's the right thing to do, which is apparently to say that I love you to that woman. Okay? But he has enough times to figure that out. Right? Now, in doing this, we are essentially assuming that we are looking at worlds that are episodic. I want you to remember that. Okay? Because if it's a non-episodic world and you reach the end, you are dead. In fact, all you have in a non-episodic world, in fact, one is important is in a non-episodic world, if you want to learn at all, it better be something else. There's another technical term we use. In non-episodic world, if you don't want to die prematurely, your world should be ergodic. Ergodic. You have to use the, what's the point in having fancy terms if you can't use it? Right? In a non-episodic world, you want to learn, your world has to be ergodic. okay? And you know, when we said this is actually a terminal state, it's like a wishy-washy terminal state. We say, you're done, now let's start all over again, you know, but really it's not. If you're really dead, you can't restart all over again. So keep that in mind. And then if in fact you do have, in a true execution kind of semantics, if you have a non-episodic world, all you have is one long episode. You may segment it. You may wind up coming to a particular state multiple times, and so if I have an infinitely large trace, infinitely large trace, then in some cases I come to the, so the trace sort of, let's say, looks like this. S0, S1, S2, S3, S4, S0, S5, S7, S8, S0, S9, S4, S5, S9. It's going like that. It's just one trace. You can say it's multiple traces by saying, oh, this is one segment of the trace. And then again, this is another segment of the trace. And it's not a bad idea because you are starting all over again from S0 a second time. Given Markovness, the value of S0 should be the same whether you started here or you here. So if you evaluate the value based on this trace and evaluate it again the value based on this trace, they should be the same. I mean, they should at least converge to the same average. What? They will be converged. Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is the thing. They're all estimating the same thing. So ultimately, they have to converge to the same value. Right? So that's something that I pushed onto the thing. In fact, an issue that will happen is you have to be awake and make sure that when I say execute, do you mean real execute or not? If you're doing real execute, then you need to talk about resettability of the world. Or in particular, it better be an episodic world so that after an episode, you can restart again. Okay? That is something that we talked about long back in 471. We never cared much about it, but now it becomes important. Okay. So then we also pointed out that, well, this one basically the problem with this, efficiency wise, it needs a lot more traces because in essence it doesn't realize that the value of this node, I mean this state, is going to be dependent on the value of its neighboring states using the dynamic programming update, the Bellman equation. So then the idea we tried was ADP. So basic idea is to just solve the Bellman equation. Okay, to solve the Bellman equations, you need the rewards, you need the transitions. So what I would then do is use the same episodes. First of all, by the way, the word episodes itself should give you an idea that this is an episodic world. Okay, if you have a long, big episode, then long, big, single trace, then you may segment it and say, this is my childhood, this is my later life, etc., etc. Okay. Anyway, so then if you have to learn the reward and transition. Reward can be learned very easily. Every time you reach that state once, the first time you reach, you remember what the reward is. You don't need to care about, you know, what it is next time because it will be the same. Reward is supposed to be the same. Okay? And if you, in fact, you are, so in fact, you can even say if the reward has a general model, which is R, S, A, S dash, then what you would say is every time you reach S dash by doing A in S, you remember the reward. Okay. Anyway, that's easy enough. And then the second one is from the same traces, same episodes. You could learn the action model. Basically, how often when you do this action in this state, you get to this state. And that's what we were talking about last time. If you do right in 3-3 state, I seem to be getting to 4-3 in 1/3 of the times I have done that. So you can look at these episodes. You can actually act as if these episodes are all concatenated.
So what happens if the reward isn't fixed?
If the reward isn't fixed in the sense the reward is changing, then it MDP is changed. And so it's no longer MDP model. That may well happen. So then what you would do is you would do piecewise MDP models. So in fact, one of the things that you have to do is, for example, you know, the state, so for example, for our own life, it is actually the case that, I mean, so you can do it in two different ways, okay? One, let me collect my thoughts. Okay, if the rewards are not fixed, then it's non-stationary rewards. It's not non-Markovian, it's non-stationary rewards. Okay, and non-stationary rewards are beyond the normal MDP. Because MDP assumes stationary, you know, stationary model as well as stationary rewards. Okay, and if you have non-stationary rewards, then one of the interesting things you will find is Bellman equations don't make sense. If you have non-stationary rewards and if you have non-stationary model and if you have non-Markovian model, then Bellman equations don't make sense. However, the Monte Carlo approach still works. And you know, so Monte Carlo works in more situations than the adaptive dynamic programming. Adaptive dynamic programming works extremely well when in fact the assumptions of MDP are satisfied. Do you understand what I'm saying? And in those cases it does extremely well. When they are not satisfied, Monte Carlo actually, you know, it makes so few assumptions that it can do well even in those, you know, more complex cases. In general, if you have situations you have where it's not an MDP, you can try to convert it into an MDP by saying piecewise linear kind of a thing, piecewise MDP. This is one MDP, this is another MDP, this is another MDP. So for example, if you believe that the rewards of being in the school depend on whether you are considered a child or a grown up or an old person, okay, then you need three MDPs, each of which have, you know, stationary reward system, for example. Okay, so this basically here you learn the model, you learn the reward system, I mean the rewards, and then you just solve the policy evaluation equations. Okay, and you remember that the policy evaluation is value of a state is the reward of that state plus the expected value of the state that it can get to doing the action the policy asks it to do. Right? Policy asks it to do. And so it gives you a set of linear equations. You solve them, you will get the values of the states. Now, if I'm doing all of this, then basically I would say that computing power is not what is the problem in doing this, right? One, you first already learned the model and the reward. If you learn the model and the reward, you don't necessarily just need to figure out what is the policy. You're also actually able to figure out the optimal policy. Because if you take the same equations and instead of just saying linear equations, if you say max over all actions, the expected value of doing that action from that state, that will give you a set of nonlinear equations, the basic Bellman equations. And if you solve them, you get the optimal policy. So this is where we ended last class. I said, well, ADP can be actually used to solve not just the current policy, just figure out what the current policy is, but also tell you what should be the optimal policy. Almost, but for the fact that it will only tell you the optimal policy with respect to the model of the actions it has learned and model of the rewards that it has learned. If that model is wrong, then the optimal policy that it learned won't be the optimal policy in the ground case, I mean in the real world, because there may be other, you know, states for which it hasn't yet gone. Okay, so the specific case that we were talking about yesterday was, the last class was, if in fact all you did in your traces was these states and you have never reached these states, and this, remember this is possible, if you started from here and started going down, you never come to this. Remember in our model when you go down, either you go this way or this way or this way. In both cases you will stay here. So you will never go up there. This was one of the models we had. And in general, I mean, in any particular, just because the actions are stochastic doesn't mean that when you do an action anything can happen, right? It only means that more than one thing can happen. It doesn't mean that every possible thing can happen. Okay, so even in stochastic worlds there you can talk about reachability, and in this particular case what happened was your traces did never reach these parts, and so if you didn't reach these parts, you would basically find an optimal policy assuming these things don't exist. And that may not be the optimal policy for the entire world. Obviously, in this particular case, it won't be. Right? Okay. So how do you avoid that? That's where the exploration comes in. Technically, you know, we have talked about it before, but here is a classic place where you're seeing it. So in general, what you need to do, if you are using reinforcement learning not only to just find the policy but to find the optimal policy, then you need to once in a while do things other than what the greedy policy is telling you to do, what the current greedy policy is telling you to do. Okay, and just so that you would have reached all the other states. Okay, now the question of course is how often do you do these exploration actions, and we'll talk about it a little bit later again. But in general, you know, the simplest idea you can try is with probability p or probability epsilon, do a random action, probability 1 minus epsilon, do the greedy action. Greedy means the best action given the current value function. Yes?
So can this be seen, I mean, just an analogy, but can it be seen as, so for example, for SRC plan, right? If you do the most likely outcome determinization, that is kind of a greedy strategy because that's the most likely outcome.
Mm-hmm.
But then to ensure completeness, to make sure you get all plans, once in a while you might have to take the support of a non-most likely effect.
Yeah, except the point is in the case of FFRE plan, all the information is available to FFRE plan upfront. It just chose to close its eyes.
No, yeah.
Whereas here, until you do act in the world, you don't know that these states exist. Right? I mean, I really did not know Santorini existed until I went there. Because, you know, there's so many, you know, things on the internet. You're not aware of all of them. So when I know that I was going there, I looked it up, and then I went there, I know it exists. So now I know where I want to go again. Okay? But until then, I just didn't know. It's not that I just ignored Santorini. No, I just didn't know it existed. Okay? So that's the point of exploration versus exploitation. And then we'll talk a little more about, you know, of course, the simple idea is to just, with some small probability, do exploration. But we can do better than that. We'll talk about a few ideas. Basically, what you need to do is, if you just do exploration for the heck of exploration, then you might be doing things that you already proved to yourself are bad. Okay, so what's the point in, you know, cutting your wrist, knowing that it's already, you know, going to cause you pain? Okay, so the idea would be you want to explore to get to states that you haven't seen at all yet, or you haven't seen often enough. So what you need to do is you need to give higher weightage to actions which will take you to states that you haven't yet visited enough.
So how do you give higher weight if you've never been there?
I'll show you a way of doing it, yes. What?
So, you've given us an example.
I mean, in the sense, if you don't know how to feel the reward, then of course you could not get the reward model. That's the other possibility. The assumption in RL here, for example, is that when you go to the state, you experience the reward. As I said, you could be depressed and you don't experience any pleasure or pain, in which case I can't help it. So that's an actually interesting case of partial observability. But nobody really talks about it. As far as I know, there is no MDP. So there is MDPs for partial observability. Those are PAMDPs. So you don't know which state you are in. As far as I know, and I may be wrong, and you can, you know, check up on the internet, I don't know MDPs which actually are partial reward models. That means they don't quite know what reward they're getting. So they have, you know, basically they're very groggy and not quite sure whether they're supposed to get pleasure out of it or not. You know, that's a different kind of a problem. It's a noise, you know, if you don't feel the reward, then, you know, you will miss, I mean, whether it's negative or positive, you are missing the advantage of the experience. And I understand that in real life, that's a very much a feasible thing. Actually, over the weekend, I was reading this article. I don't know how many of you know this. I think 2007, a Washington Post reporter basically wanted to question whether or not people will realize beauty when they see it. This is classic case. What?
There was a show on.
Oh, really? Okay. So this guy, basically, they took a world-class violinist, Joshua Bell, and put him in La Fan Plaza, And then he was playing. I mean, normally to just go to listen to him, you have to pay $1,000 to get a good seat, $100 to stand in the back. And he was just doing a free concert with a little, you know, thing to get money. And then the question is, you know, people are obviously hurried and they're going off to, you know, catch buses and catch trains and catch, go to their boring work. How many of them will stop? You know, I mean, I think that's a good question. You know, if you experience reward, would you enjoy, would you realize that you experienced it?
But isn't it a cultural thing?
I don't know. I mean, it doesn't matter. These are supposedly in the same culture, right? I mean, there are enough people from the same culture. My only point is, just because there is a reward, you may not necessarily realize it. And MDPs assume so. So that means if there is a reward, then you experience it. So if you are missing the reward, then that's a different level of complexity. That's a different assumption that's being violated. Okay? Okay, so we did this, and then what we're going to do is actually temporal difference learning, Q learning, TD Lambda, all of which essentially are somewhere between ADP and Monte Carlo learning. Okay, and they kind of so between ADP and Monte Carlo, which of them would you call model free and which of them would you call model based? ADP is model based because it needs the model. Monte Carlo, on the other hand, is model free because it just looks at the states it went through, adds up the rewards. It doesn't model, in our terminology, is the probabilities of actions taking you from one state to another state. That's the only model. That's the only thing that we care about. Okay. So we'll look at a few more model-free. In fact, you know, this whole idea of temporal difference learning, which is also a model-free idea. And it can be seen as sort of a dumbing down of Monte Carlo in one dimension and dumbing up, I mean, and then making it smarter in another dimension. So like Monte Carlo, it depends on the actual trace. But unlike Monte Carlo, it actually uses the Bellman equation. Okay? Yes? What? We assume discounted rewards normally.
So, we have learning
That
would probably actually do it in the Monte Carlo. When you add up the rewards.
Yeah. So the idea is, if in a Monte Carlo you have a long sequence, and if your discount factor gamma is very close to like zero, then really the length doesn't matter. You may as well take the first 100 and stop. Because in practice, the average that you get with first 100 versus first 1000 is going to be negligibly different. No, but I mean, that's the thing. So length, as I said, the length is the issue that I was talking about. I think you came in late. The length is the issue where you can either end in a terminal state and then reset, which is episodic, or if it's a non-episodic, there is no end to your experience. It's just going on and on and on and on. And then you can take different windows of this and then talk about, you can consider each of these as a pseudo trace. Right? And then, you know, one of the interesting things is, you would say, well, if this is ending here, S4 is not terminating state, what do I do with S4? Well, just take its reward. And if I tell you that gamma is close to 0.1, which basically means more or less beyond 100 states, however high the reward is. So imagine the following thing. Like, suppose I tell you the R max, which is the highest reward you can ever get in any state. Okay, and if I tell you gamma, and if I tell you the precision that I want my value function to have, like it should be correct up to two decimal digits, then I argue that you can actually tell what is the maximum length that you need to consider at all, beyond which the first two decimal digits won't change anymore. Right? So discounting essentially makes an infinitely long trace finitely long. That's more or less what we were looking at previously too. Okay. So one thing that, before I go forward, I want to make something else, come up, which, you have it in the back of your head, which is this crazy connection between learning, planning, acting. You know, once you got into the reinforcement learning, it looks like there's very little difference between learning, planning, acting. And there isn't much of a difference between them. Okay? And so here is a nice yin and yang picture. So think of value and policy is what you need to know for your MDP. If you know the value and policy, you can do acting in the world. I mean, value or policy, really. Okay, either value or policy, because one and both, they're both duals of each other. You have one, you can get the other in many cases. Okay, so if you have value policy, if you act, you get experience. Now, when you get experience, you can directly use the experience to improve the value and policy, which is what Monte Carlo would do. This is sort of a short circuit. Or you can use the experience to learn the model, which is the action model. Once you have the model, you can do planning, which is basically normal value policy iteration or LRTDP or FFRE plan or, you know, all the stochastic planning algorithms we looked at, which will give you value and policy. So that's the kind of cycle you have. Okay? So it's not surprising that what you do here is sort of similar to what you do in reinforcement learning too, because in essence, if you know the model, you plan with respect to that, you get to a value and policy. And if you don't yet have a complete value and policy, then you use the current value and policy, do some bit of exploration in acting, you get experience, which can then be used to improve your model, and then act with respect to that, and then plan with respect to that. So planning essentially can be thought of as getting you to value and policy. Learning can be thought of as getting you to value and policy. Planning exploits what you have, which is the model. So there is like an intermediate step before you. So model plus planning is the same as direct RL in terms of getting to the value function. Okay? Now, the other interesting thing, of course, is that this business of experience and acting can be done in the real world. In here I said real world, really. You know, when I showed this picture, I assume there's only action in the real world. But you can act in your mind, which would be simulated experience. And you can use reinforcement learning over simulated experience. And you can also use reinforcement learning on real experience. And, you know, yesterday, the day before yesterday, when I was talking to you guys about the helicopter thing, for example, that was simulated. What it does is they learn based not on, you know, it essentially has to look at a huge number, like billions and billions of traces, you know, of helicopter trying to be, you know, this thing, and it's falling off. Now, I know that Andrew Ng lives in Stanford, but even he doesn't have money to actually kill so many helicopters, even if they're toy helicopters. So what he instead has is a good simulator. Do you understand what I'm saying? What he has is a good simulator. So now I am differentiating between three things, as if life is not hard enough. The world, the model, the simulator. What's the difference? The idea is that simulator doesn't have to be declarative. It's just a black box. Okay? So for example, flight simulators exist. And pilots try the flight simulators to learn flight, you know, learn how to fly before they actually learn on the real flight. Flight simulators are not completely high fidelity. They are actually not exactly the same as the real flight, but they come close enough, you know, because they spend a lot of time on, you know, making these things. But they're not declarative. You can't actually reason about flight simulator in search. You can't do regression over them, for example. All you can do is give them an action, they'll give you an outcome back. Whereas having a model is more than that. Basically, you have an action, you know its preconditions, you know its effects, you know everything before you even call the action. Whereas otherwise, if you have a simulator, you give the action signal, it will give you the output signal. Okay? So simulator is sort of a model sit-in, but you still need, even if you have a simulator, you may still not be able to do bunches of things that you could do using the declarative planning techniques, because there is no action model It's all in there as a big program. No, but what I'm saying is, again, the real question is, you could say the simulator is the model. That's it. Okay, and nothing else. Or, but we are used to, I mean, one of the advantages of declarative models is, you know, whatever it is, if you like the precondition effect model, given an action, you know what it would need for it to be taking place in the world and what it is likely to change after the action is done. And you can do this before actually doing it either in the real world or on the simulator, because you have the description of the action. A flight simulator, on the other hand, the interesting thing about flight simulator is you have to actually do it on the flight simulator, and it will tell you, oh, you're falling, no, you're going up too much. Okay, it basically combines all the influences into, you know, some particular way of giving you the output signal. So if you, one of the interesting things is simulators are probably not all that useful for the planning methods we have learned until now. But they can be useful for reinforcement learning methods. Do you understand what I'm saying? Because instead of acting in the real world, they can act on the simulator and learn. So this is why it's interesting to know the difference. Okay. Now this entire simulator-based thing is very worrisome for AI folks, because that means that we don't need knowledge representation. We don't need explicit models. You can have black box simulators and somebody will learn. The only good point is, while simulators can get you so far, there are also many situations where, unless you have factored representations, you know, basically you cannot scale up. One of the dirty secrets about reinforcement learning is it's a beautiful theory. You know, you look at pictures like this and you say, why am I doing anything else other than this? The problem is it doesn't scale. In fact, towards the end of this slide, you will see, you know, small domains with 10,000 states, and they already say reinforcement learning doesn't work very well there. And so you need abstractions and you need all sorts of other things. Okay? And so, but it's worth knowing that if you have simulators, so this one is a particular architecture realization of this picture. Here you could do real experience on the environment and you can change the policy. Or you have a simulator, you basically simulate and, you know, figure out what happens and then change the policy value function. Both are possible. So you can, you know, and in some sense, one can say that if you are using just the simulator, then is it learning or is it planning? Neither, really. It depends on, you know, whether you consider simulator to be model, in which case it's planning, or you consider that to be a stand-in for the environment, then it's learning. Yes?
So
No, that is different. So the idea is the entire Monte Carlo thing can also be seen as simulation. Here also you got actions and you got outcomes out. The real question is, where did these actions get done? Did they get done in real world versus some black box model? Okay. In the case of LRTDP, for example, when you simulate an experience, you are simulating it. You're not doing it in the world. So what you did was, in essence, you know, the LRTDP has an actual explicit model of actions. It sort of used that as the simulator, and it gave, you know, I want to do this action, and the simulator says this will be your state. So simulator can be derived either automatically from a declarative information or has been written by somebody. So if you have this fully, then you can get this free. But many a time you can have this without having this. Flight simulators are the case in point, where we don't quite have a declarative model of how to fly things, but we have simulators. And this is true for many, many things. You know, there are simulators for many worlds, without having models. And it's trickier to understand. I mean, one of the harder things that you want to understand is, what do you lose? You can easily see what you lose by acting versus thinking. You know, if you act, you get into trouble. If you think, you can only see that you can get into trouble and avoid it in during action. So acting and thinking, very easy to see which is good. Simulating and thinking, or simulating and acting, those differences are more subtle. Okay, what I would like you to understand, and if possible, is that having a model gives you more flexibility than just having simulator. Because, you know, it's a good question. No, the interesting thing is, yes, but can you write down a model in any formal language that I can reason with?
But you have to have defined the model in order to simulate the behavior. Usually.
No, all I'm saying is that I could write a program, and I say this program will give you, so it's like procedural semantics.
Yeah,
this program will tell you approximately what happens when you do an action. That's a procedural simulation, okay, procedural semantics. A declarative semantics will tell you, if you call this action with this probability, this state will happen, this probability, this state will happen. You can use those probabilities in any which way you want during thinking. As I said, simulator versus model is a more subtle concept, but it's something that you can, you basically, for example, LRTDP, I would say, is using explicit model as a simulator to make pseudo experience, which from which it in some sense learning. You can think of LRTDP as doing reinforcement learning in that way. Okay? Yes? It's not asking, it's doing it itself. No, FF3 plan it basically, FF3 plan has the action model completely in front of it. Okay, so here is actually a very interesting question. Suppose instead of giving you the action model, your FF3 plan, instead of giving you the action model, I just gave you the simulator for the domain. How does FF3 plan work in such a case? Or somebody like FF3 plan, what do they do if all they have is a simulator, not the model? Because in essence, one of the tricky things is simulator only gives you what states happened. FF3 plan is getting deterministic action descriptions, not states. It's getting a problem description. It's not getting a sequence of states. It gets a problem description and it uses a planner to solve the optimal policy for that. I would argue that if all you have is just a simulator, then you cannot do FF3 plan. You can only essentially do Monte Carlo.
But you can, can't you exploit
and
you can actually learn.
That's fine. That's fine. So you can, if I just give you this, so the thing is that I have world, I have simulator, I have model. Sometimes more information is in the simulator, and sometimes, you know, model contains everything, and so you can derive the simulator. You know, if there is no model, only simulator, you may be able to compute the model. But then you have to be sure as to why you are doing it. Why should I compute the model? In fact, one of the crazy things, and this is like, you know, kind of a devil's advocacy for planning, right? I mean, until here, we basically assumed we need models and we need to do search over the models. Reinforcement learning questions that. Why do you need models? All you need to know is what to do. And I'll tell you what to do. And you need to have a more complex explanation as to why you still need models. It has to be computational explanation. The idea is that without the models, it will be slower or less scale up.
And it costs. I mean, that's what most people use the model, right? I mean, it's very costly to act in the world. I mean,
No. Simulator is not real world. See, cost, no, again, as I said, I think this discussion is, it's very easy to tell why you should think versus act. It's very easy to tell. But it's much harder to tell why you should explicit why you need explicit models versus simulator, because you can think quote unquote with a simulator, because when you simulate the world doesn't change. Do you understand what I'm saying? See, this is an interesting point that you did not have to deal with up until now, and now you have to deal with it in spades, because you know of many domains where there exist simulators and they don't have models, and they do want people to come up with models for them. So in fact, learning models are useful. Why is it useful? I believe you know the answer. For example, FF replan can't be done. And to the extent you think determinization and solving the problem is somehow better than just Monte Carlo, then you need model. There is no simulator which will give you determinization. Simulators give you traces. Yes? The point is, here's the thing, I know how to walk. Can I make a robot walk? Even now we don't know how to make the robot walk. So the question is that just because we know something, I mean, there's this whole entire issue that declarative representations of certain kinds, you know, so I may be able to do things without knowing how I am able to do it.
No, I mean, there's a model of walking now. That's how you make a robot walk. I mean, you know how humans walk, you know. I mean, for example...
No, but if that was so easy, we've been walking for a long time, and robotics existed for a long time, and the bipedal locomotion was, even now, very awkward. It's very awkward. Okay? So the point is, so again, this is again a subtle point, that why is it the case that there are airplane simulators but not airplane PDDL models? Why? Is it just because PDDL doesn't have numeric effects, or is it more than that?
No, for example, just to finish this, right? If you have an airplane simulator, that simulator has to be written in some declarative fashion.
No, but that way everything is declarative. Any program is declarative that way. But
some model, right?
I understand. I understand. The question is whether you can reason with the model. There is an inference technique for that model. If you can do reasoning over programs, you don't need this class. Right? I mean, that is just, you know, that if you can reason over programs, and if you can, for example, tell, oh, this program won't terminate. Yeah, you don't need this class. But in 355, you already figured out that is a GAN case. Okay, there's a level of representation. Everything is represented, but, you know, do I have the inference mechanisms for that is the real question. And this is this is a subtle point. I mean, I understand why you're confused. I won't be surprised at all. I would be surprised if you're not confused. Okay, but, you know, please think about it and ask more questions later. Discuss it on the, you know, blog and whatever. You can get optimal plan even with the simulator. It'll take longer. Okay. Ultimately, model versus simulator winds up being one of efficiency. Whereas thinking versus acting, I mean, planning versus just random acting, winds up being one of survival, which is a bigger deal. You can say that's also efficiency, but, you know, survival is a bigger deal than just being faster.
So can you ask your question again?
Yes.
You said, why is the model needed?
Yeah.
Right? Is that what you said?
No, the point is, if I have a simulator, why do I need models in general? You need to understand that. Otherwise, then you'll just get by with simulators itself. Okay? You need to understand that by having a model, you can do things that you can't do otherwise. Okay, so I mean, think about it this way, right? I mean, why do you need to know this? I know this stuff. You can call me every once in a while. I'll tell you this stuff. I'm your simulator. Okay, why are you trying to figure out how to do this yourself? In some sense, that's also related. You know, a simulator knows it, but it'll only give you answers. Whereas you want to be able to actually do more than just, okay, if I do this, I'll have this state. You want to actually be able to do both forward and backward reasoning over actions. You should be able to string actions in any arbitrary way and say, this partial plan will have this kind of a behavior. You can't talk about partial plans in simulators. Okay. Anyway, so that's sort of getting this, you know, into your head is a useful thing. We are not sitting here writing simulators, but if there are simulators, we should be able to use it. Okay. So now we let's talk about model-free learning, which basically is why bother learning the transition function? Why not just go directly from experience to policy, experience to value or policy, which in some sense is possible, right? I'm showing you this picture, and Monte Carlo will get you like this. The only problem was Monte Carlo was too slow. Okay, so the question is, can you do, the problem with Monte Carlo was that it was not using the connection between the states. They have constraints, local constraints between the values of neighboring states, where neighbors are defined in terms of actions. Monte Carlo wasn't using it. So let's make it use it. Okay, so here is the idea for temporal difference learning. So you started from S, you did an action A. Let's assume there is a value function always. You are just trying to improve it. It's like the LRTDP model. There's a current estimate of value function everywhere. And you're just trying to improve it by doing more and more actions. Okay? In the beginning, you can say zero for everybody if you want. Okay? So right now, you know the value of this state. You have an estimate. So you're in this state. You did action A. Okay? And based on, if you know the model of the action, okay, based on what that action could have taken you to, what states it could have taken you to, all the F dashes, and the rewards of those states, okay, if you add these, this would be essentially the true value of F that's supposed to be backed up. Okay. Now, in the sample, when I did action A, it turned out that I only got F dash. Only one real state happened. In a sample, actually a particular state happens, not all states. It actually gave me F dash, okay? And then my question, of course, is F dash has a value currently. It's my current estimate of F dash value. So I could also say by sample, I would say that what my value should be is this plus gamma times the current estimate of the F dash's value. If my value function is correct, optimal, I would say these two would have been close. They would have been same essentially. In an average sense. Okay? So if I take the difference between this and this, that is the amount by which this guy's value has to be changed to be consistent with the current sample. Except an example might be a little different. So I don't want to overreact. I want to nudge the value of state S towards its true value with respect to the sample a little bit. So what I do is I take this difference multiplied by alpha, which is the learning rate parameter, let's say 0.01 or something. Okay, a small parameter, less than one parameter, and then you multiply that difference with that and add it to your current value. And that you would reset as the new value of S. Okay? This is crazily like what? I mean, those of you who remember even perceptron learning in neural networks. What? Yes, exactly. So perceptron learning is done this way too, right? In fact, perceptron learning is supposed to be done over all the samples and all the error over all the samples. But normally, the iterative approaches would do one sample at a time. They update the weights. And still, you know that it will converge under certain conditions. Now, you know, from here onwards, actually, the understanding the methods is easy. Proving that they converge is hard. Thankfully, I won't tell you the proofs. Okay, I mean, thankfully for me, not for you. Okay, so there are actually two different books on reinforcement learning. One is this. This is great to read. I mean, I gave you a link to this, right? This is great book to read to get an idea of all the algorithms and the intuitive explanation of why those algorithms make sense. And then if you want to actually prove that these things converge to the optimal value and policy functions in the limit, you need a different book. This is a book by Bertsakis and Tsitsiklis. In fact, those guys have, if you look at the back of this book, they write the first comment on that, and they say this is a highly intuitive and accessible introduction. And you normally think if anybody says highly intuitive, it's a good thing. But if Bertrekar says it's highly intuitive, what he means is you guys don't know math, because he's a mathematician. So he actually has a different book, you know, where, which is actually it's called Neurodynamic Programming, which is at my home right now, and that one gives all the proofs as to when things converge, etc. In fact, the convergence results are few and far between in reinforcement learning. Okay, and in fact, one of the even more interesting things is that if you read the first chapter of the Neurodynamic Programming, it's very interesting. The way Bertrekar says is, for the past several years, people in AI have been jumping up and down, thinking this reinforcement learning stuff works. We ignored them for a while, but they still seem to be jumping up and down. So I've decided to figure out whether it actually has any theory. I mean, he doesn't say it exactly in those words, but if you read the first chapter, that's what it says. Okay, and the good answer is that yes, there is a theory, and that in fact, in most cases, it does converge. But somebody has to prove it, and you know, that's a very important contribution too. Okay, so for example, if I do this, the fact that if you do this often enough, you will converge to the actual value function. I'm just hand waving right now, and I'm saying, remember, you did this kind of a thing for neural networks, but that's not a proof. Okay, and if you want, you know, there is a formal proof, for example, that which basically says as long as you know alpha is such that certain conditions are satisfied on the learning rate parameter, then you are guaranteed to converge in the limit. Okay, okay, so that's temporal difference learning, and it's called temporal difference learning because you are taking states separated in time. State S is in time 0, state S dash is in time 1. And you are just saying, in essence, that look, you know, if in fact things are in, you know, if things are all consistent, then the current value of S should be very close to the backed up value of S from this level. Now, the only tricky thing is, notice that you would have completely agreed with this temporal difference learning. Okay, so here is another interesting way of looking at it. How many of you see a connection between this and game tree search? I'll say, ignore the dot, dot, dot. Think of them as if all of them, you know, are solid. Okay, then I'd say what game tree search does is for all the states at the bottom, it gives their evaluation, not their true values, because in the game tree search, you may not be able to reach to a true win, loss, and draw. So you just give an evaluation of the state. And then you back it up using mins and maxes. Right? In fact, RTDP would have done an action A, considered all possible outcomes that can happen because it knows the model. Do you understand what I'm saying? RTDP knows the model, so it knows what actions, what outcomes can happen and with what probabilities they will happen. And it can compute the expected value of this action at the reward that would be the backed up value. If I said it that way, you would have said, yeah, this makes sense. It's just one step look ahead. What's tricky is I can't get you these rest of the guys because I don't have the model. In fact, one of the reasons I'm doing this is not to have to have a model. Let the world be its own model. Okay, now, you know, obviously you can see that, look, this is probably a very unlikely outcome for this action. In this particular case, it happened, but maybe it won't happen ever again. You're right. But however, since the world is its own model, next time around when I try to do this action in this state, I'll get one of the other outcomes. In particular, the number of times this outcome will occur in one of the traces will be proportional to its true probability. And the number of times this will occur will be proportional to its true probability. And that's why I'm nudging only alpha times. So if you think of these, essentially what you can say is the temporal difference learning is computing the expected value returned except one path at a time. That's the intuition. And these paths are basically what you backed up on this path is being remembered in the current value. Next time when you got, let's say, this path, you would again get an extra alpha back. That could be negative. Notice that this addition doesn't have to be positive. It can be negative. So it goes up, comes down, goes up, comes down. And in fact, the way it goes up and comes down would be proportional to the actual true probabilities of those outcomes occurring for that action. That's why TD will converge. And it also tells you that if you had the model, and you did TD, temporal difference learning, you should be called a smart guy or a dumb guy?
Dumb guy.
Right? Because why the heck would you need to do this? You know, if you have the model, you can actually figure out what are all these states and get the expectation, and one fell swoop, you will get the DP backup. So who does the DP backup? ADP does the DP backup. RTDP and ADP, they do the DP backup. Okay? You are not doing DP backup because you don't have the model. Okay? And so this makes sense when you don't have the model. And in fact, you can say, it's a good thing, sometimes I don't want to learn the model. I just want to know what the value is. Okay? So here is an example. You know, you can go through this, essentially, here is one trace, here is another trace, and you can, if your gamma is 1, which is basically discounting is not there, and alpha is 0.5, you can say how the values change. You can try it out. Yes? Okay, you tell me. Because it's late, end of the class, and you're asleep. I mean, you're not asleep, some other class, but, you know, is it different or not? Am I smart or not? So at least I knew you were going to ask this question. So, why is it different from Monte Carlo? It's different from Monte Carlo, I would say, in terms of the trace, the same way limited depth min max is different from full min max. Full min max has to extend the search tree. I mean, nobody else will explain it this way, you know, because I think min max games normally are more complex than single agent search. But you know games, game tree search. So with respect to that, if you did full min max, then everything would be a terminal state and you back up from there. Okay, I'm sorry. I do have to take this call, sorry. Hello? Okay, no, I think I'll leave this. My son basically is coming back from school and he had to open the door and get in because my wife is in Finland. And so, you know, I just told him when he gets in, call me. So that's all. Okay. Sorry. The idea is that you could say that in Monte Carlo, what you're doing is also it's a single trace, except the trace is extended either to infinity, such that later states almost don't matter because of the discount. Okay, I have to take this call. Hello? Yeah, you got in, right? Okay, thank you. Sorry, guys. Okay, so Monte Carlo goes all the way to the simplest case is to assume that you reach the terminal state, but it doesn't have to be a terminal state. If it is infinitely long, as I pointed out to you, it's as if you reach the terminal state because beyond a certain length, it doesn't matter. Right? Okay? On the other hand, so what you can say is even though Monte Carlo is working that way, I would argue that Monte Carlo is doing the same thing that TD is doing. Remember what TD that we did is doing. It went from here to here. It took the value of this state, added it to the reward of the previous state, gamma times the value of this. What Monte Carlo would do is it will take reward for all these states and multiply it by gamma, gamma square, gamma cube, etc. Except if this is a terminal state, the reward of the state is the same as the value of the state. So I would say Monte Carlo is an infinite step temporal difference learning. Okay? It's the same thing in game trees. You know, you can go one ply deep, backup, many ply deep, backup. Going many ply is always better. Right? Except game tree connection to this is slightly iffy because in the game tree you also have the model, so you look at all the other states. So in essence, think of doing game tree search by making single probe all the way deep. Not the tree isn't being expanded. And some of you in the room will know UCT, Monte Carlo with UCT, and that's what it does. It basically does single probes all the way down. Okay. So this is a Monte Carlo probe, and you can back up on this. TD is backing up with one step. Why should it be one step? Why not two step? Why not three step? So the real question is, where do you apply the evaluation function? In game trees, we know that going a little deeper and applying the evaluation function there is better than applying it right away. Right? And for the reasons we know, you know, because like traps, etc., become obvious. And the same thing here. Okay? So in general, TD one step versus Monte Carlo, you would say the backup's value would be sort of higher if it is longer. Except the longer sequences, the Monte Carlo has its other own problems, right? Because in essence, if you have an infinitely long trace, basically the problem that Monte Carlo had is it wasn't actually exploiting the fact that the neighboring states are connected. And plus, each update would be costly. Okay? So the only thing you kind of know is one step, two step, three step, n step, Monte Carlo being infinite step. The most efficient may be somewhere in between. It's neither in the very beginning nor in the very end. And if you think so, then you're right. And that this picture is essentially saying that if you consider the RMS value, with respect to different alpha values, different learning rate values, and what you want to see is where is the minimum occurring, where is the lowest error occurring, and how low is the lowest error. Okay, so for example, five-step learning comes here. Five-step learning became minimum, you know, it has the lowest error, five-step backup. On the other hand, here is a 60-step backup. That doesn't have a lower error, it has a higher error. Okay, also there is a one-step backup. That also has a higher error than the five-step backup. Just like, you know, heuristics, should it be close to perfect search or should it be totally just zero heuristic? It's somewhere in between. Okay? So if you understand temporal difference learning, then multi-step temporal difference backups tend to be, somewhere in between, tend to be the better way of exploiting your experience and your current estimate. So it's like there are two things that are going on. One is you have an estimate of the values of the states. The other is you also have an experience, and you need to use both of them judiciously. If you go this way too far, then you're completely ignoring your current values because you're going all the way essentially until the current value estimate doesn't matter. So even if I gave you a value estimate that's extremely close to the optimal values, if you do Monte Carlo, you don't really know the difference. Because you keep going until you hit either the terminal state or it doesn't matter what the value is. So you're only using rewards, even though I gave you close to optimal value. Whereas this guy would be able to use that. On the other hand, if I gave you a value function that's kind of iffy, it's wrong, then this guy would be easily misled. This guy won't be. So you want both, you be in the middle. Okay, this is multi-step temporal difference learning backup. Yes?
Alpha is
the learning rate, which is basically how fast you nudge the value towards the difference.
The current model that you have learned.
No. Alpha is just the learning rate parameter. It's like you have a, so remember in neural networks, you know, the weights have to be shifted towards, shifted such that the outcome is going to be correct, right? The question is, are you going to just make them right away, or do you just shift it a little towards that? And if alpha is too small, what you're seeing here is, if alpha is zero, things aren't looking good. And if it's alpha is very high, things aren't looking good either. It's in between somewhere. Okay? Now, what's interesting is that there is a very well-known idea called TD lambda. Okay, lambda temporal difference learning. And you would have thought that lambda there should be k step. Lambda is k. No, it's not. It's not TDK, it's TD lambda. And Greeks do things differently. So what lambda, TD lambda is actually an idea that's used a lot. And what it does is, in essence, you can think of what it does as the following. Remember, previously you knew that I could have computed this guy's value estimate. Remember, suppose I gave you a sequence of length k, a trace of length k. Even though I gave you the trace of length k, I could use just the length 1, use the value function at the first state, backup. Length 2, value function at the second one, backup. Length 3, use the value function at the third one, backup. All of these are estimates of f value. So what's the true estimate? It's some weighted average of all these estimates. TD lambda essentially does a weighted average of all these backups. Okay, that's essentially what it does. This is a picture. So it does TD step TD k equal to 1 backup, and that value, it has a value, it says 1 minus lambda times that value plus lambda, 1 minus lambda times the next value plus 1 minus lambda times lambda square of the third value and so on. So what happens if lambda equal to 1? What happens if lambda equal to 1? I'm sorry, no, what happens if lambda equal to 0? If lambda equal to 0, the weighted average, these things don't make any difference. Only this matters. And so lambda equal to 0, TD lambda is the same as TD 1, except k equal to 1. But lambda equal to 0.7, things change. Because so here you are talking about number of steps over which you are doing backups. Here you are saying I'll do all those backups at the same time, and then add up the backed up values. So in fact, again going back to the game trees, you did consider doing something like this. Not exactly this. Remember, to consider whether or not the game tree reached the quiescence, you would keep backing up values from second level, third level, fourth level, and see how much is the backed up value changing. And if it's changing too much, then you go a few more ply. If it stops changing, you stop before a few more ply. That's how you were using it at that time. Here you are essentially kind of saying it's a weighted average, a particular kind of weighted average in terms of lambda, which is yet another parameter. So TD lambda, TD itself has an alpha parameter, which is just the learning rate. And TD lambda is basically going to do a lambda parameter for combining the one step, two step, etc., k step backups into a single backup. What? That's what I'm saying. So you would do, you have to understand how to do a backup here, for example. If I give you this trace, how would you do the backup here? You would find out this value, gamma times this value plus reward of the, you start from here, reward of this state plus gamma times the reward of this state plus gamma square times the reward of the next state, etc., up to the last state where you just take its value. So you can essentially think of this as truncating the experience. I wrote that here. In essence, Monte Carlo would have a long sequence and it only has to add up the rewards, never has to use the values. If I decide to take an infinitely long sequence and truncate it at the kth level, then I would take just the value of the last state as the stand-in for the summation of the missing part of the sequence. So I would do 1 plus, reward plus gamma times the next reward plus gamma square times the next reward plus gamma cube times the next reward plus gamma power k times the value of the last state. If it went on, then you would have said gamma power k times the reward of the kth state plus gamma power k plus 1 times the reward of the next state, etc., etc. Since there are no more states, you just take its value and then gamma power k. Okay? And so you do this for each of these and you get one backup in each time. You have to try these out. If this were an undergraduate course, I can give you problems and you can solve it and then ITA will grade it and then you can feel good or not bad. But you have to do it yourself. It's up to you. If you didn't understand it, you want to check, the textbook is available. I gave you a link to it. It has examples worked out, and you can try it out yourself. You know, it's up to you. Okay. Okay. So that's your TD lambda. And again, it turns out that TD lambda also winds up being, you know, lambda equal to 0, it's one step. It turns out that if lambda equal to 1, it's not exactly Monte Carlo. It's something in between Monte Carlo and TD0, because it takes, you know, backups from all of these and adds them up. However, the behavior turns out to be that the lambda between 0 and 1 tends to be better than lambda equal to 1 or lambda equal to 0. Lambda equal to 1 is sort of close to Monte Carlo. It's not exactly Monte Carlo. K equal to infinity here is Monte Carlo. Lambda equal to 1 here only means all the summation, all the weights, I mean all the backups are being given equal weight, essentially.
But
yes?
Zero.
What? I'll get back to you. It's that's what it looks like. You know, essentially it does become closer to Monte Carlo. I'll get back to you on this. Okay? So in essence, what you would see is, again, you know, in this case too, for example, the minimum error, which is the only thing that you care about, seems to happen for lambda equal to 0.8, not for lambda equal to 0, not for lambda equal to 1. TD versus TD, so which one do you like? So that I have to say why the other one makes sense. So basically, the question is, I gave you a k, so here, think about it this way. I gave you a k length trace.
Yes.
TD ignores everything after the first, and just it's eagerly backing up after the first one itself. TD lambda, on the other hand, backs up once here, all the way up to k, and then considers all those weighted averages, and essentially sums them up. I mean, basically sums them up in a weighted way. In the game tree terminology, actually, what you would wind up doing is this is given the full weight. Everything else is given zero weight. Right? Because the deeper one wins directly in the game tree. Okay? So you should think of this as using the entire experience, not just two states. Okay, so for example, let's say what could happen is that I have a state which, when I do an action, gets into a state which looks very good, so I feel this should be good too, but then right after that gets into a really bad state. So if I only look two steps ahead, I would have said this is not a particularly good state. And then maybe it'll go up again. So in which case I'll change my mind. Okay? The issue, of course, is, you know, long term, when I start behaving from here, do things go up or down? And the longer, the more you see, the better your estimate would be. Okay? Except the more you see, in essence, I mean, if you want longer and longer sequences, the backup takes more time. Okay? So that's TD lambda. Now, the last thing I'll say today, and then we'll have one more class on reinforcement learning, which I guess is good because you'll be hopefully having lots of questions for next time, that we will, TD basically is a model-free method. Both TD and TD lambda are model-free methods, right? Because they're never actually figuring out what are the probabilities that actions will take you from one state to another state. They're just directly figuring out the values, which is completely fine if all you want to do is passive learning. If you want to do active learning, then suppose you did active learning. Suppose I told you how to convert this into active learning, such that you will get the optimal value function, not just the value function corresponding to the current policy. So you found the optimal value function. Now tell me what action you are supposed to do in this state. Remember, I always told you, if you have a value, you can get the state, you know, action, right? But that's because we knew that we'll both have model and reward and the value function. And so if I have the model and the reward and the value, if I have both model and the value, then given value, I can get policy, and given policy, I can get value. If the model is missing, then I can't convert the value into policy. Right? I mean, it's only after things miss that you realize, you know, that they're important. So now that the model is missing, you can't convert, you know, value into policy. So that looks like it's like a, you know, model-based people's dream come true. They can say, oh, model-free guys are sunk now because they only got the value. They can't do anything with it. They don't know how to use it to act. It turns out, however, that really you can think in terms of Q values. What's a Q value? Q value is, you know, if you have a state S, we talked about it, if you have a state S, the value of this state is starting from this state, if you behave using the optimal policy, what is the aggregated average reward you get? Q value is starting from, so it will be with respect to an action A, QAS. Starting from this state, if you do action A, then from there onwards, what is the total amount of aggregated reward you get? Now, you clearly know that if suppose there are A1, A2, A3, A4 that can be done from this state, I can then get QA1S, QA2S, QA3S, QA4S. But suppose actually I got the optimal Q values. Then I argue you know the value, right? Max of these is the value. Okay? Now it turns out Q values are just like values, and so you can actually write the same temporal difference equations rather than in terms of values that you did here. You can write it in terms of the Q values. Instead of V star, you write in terms of Q star. If you do that, you have more unknowns that you are going to, you know, estimate. But the advantage of this is you can tell your model-based friend, go suck an egg, because I still don't need to know what an action does. I just know the values of the actions, and I'll, you know, when I compute the Q values, I have the V star, and then when I'm done with the Q learning, I will, suppose this is my, you know, world, you know, normally value function would have told you V star of each of these. Instead, now this one, these are the up, down, sideways actions, you know, down, right, left, up. And I gave you the numbers for all those actions. Those are the Q values. I argue that you know the value function there, right? What's the value of this state here? What is the value of this state here? 0.42, because there are four Q values. One of them is 0.42. The max is the value of that state. If I only gave you 0.42, you don't know what do I do to get that. If I gave you the Q values, now if you are in this state, what's the action you're supposed to do? Go right. Go right, right, 42, 0.42. Yeah, so this arrow. I mean, I don't know. I made it up like that. I assume that it's right. I don't know. In fact, it's probably the case that it's actually the opposite. You're right. In fact, given the numbers, it would be the other way. I just viewed it as arrows, but, you know. But you're right. So essentially, this is, I guess, this is going right, this is going left, this is going up, this is going down. And so clearly, this is telling you go left, which is the correct thing to do there. Is there a big difference between Q learning and TD learning? Nothing. Okay, instead of learning, if there were n states, Q learning tries to estimate n values for the states. If there are n states and a actions per state, Q learning, instead of TD learning estimates n values, Q learning estimates n times a Q values. Okay, but it doesn't need to know what the model is. So if you want to get a badge for living without the model, Q learning is your way to go. Now, of course, because Q learning is so closely connected to the temporal difference learning, basically it's the same thing, except in terms of temporal difference learning is in terms of value functions, Q learning is in terms of Q value functions. So just as you have TD, you can have, and TD and TD lambda, you can have Q and Q lambda, which does exactly the same thing except for the Q values. Yes? What?
Q, when you're doing the math, for all the actions,
mm-hmm. Well, it's not, I mean, first of all, what we are doing in all these cases is sort of LMS descent. I'm not sure. So you're saying that Q learning is somehow closer to perceptron? Well, it depends. I mean, TD is a place to start from. You're right. You know, Q learning is obviously what everybody uses eventually, because you need to figure out what action to do. And what's interesting also is that once you're doing Q learning, then you can, when we come back next class, we can talk about exploration and exploitation with respect to the Q learning. So the basic idea, it would be that you would have computed the Q values for all the actions, and then you would try with epsilon probability do an action that's one of the actions, and 1 minus epsilon probability do the max Q valued action. That would be exploration versus exploitation. And there is a better idea that we will talk about, which basically tries to say, take the value estimate and count, and which basically tells you how many times you have gone to this state. How many times you have gone to this state. And this is, Loretta, this is your answer to your question. We'll come back to it. Which is, if I have come to this state multiple times already, then in essence, its value is already known. I mean, if I come to this state with this action multiple times before, then this Q value doesn't need to be given any boost. Things that haven't been seen yet, what you would wind up doing is you'll take their current value estimate plus add a bonus. That bonus is only that you are a new kid in the block, you need to get a bonus. And this bonus will go down as you're no longer a new kid in the block. You've been seen more than n times, I mean more than k times, then the addition is going to be a fractional number. This will essentially, you know, wind up supporting, you know, exploration of states that you haven't seen. And there are even better ideas. For example, explore areas whose badness is not yet established. So actually look at values and then see if they're negative and they haven't changed much in the last several times, in the last several estimates. This is sort of like the quiescence idea. Then don't waste time exploring those particular few values. And if you push it to its logical extreme, it sort of becomes, again, for those of you who know UCT, it becomes sort of a related to UCT idea. Because you basically are deciding whether or not it's worth knowing more about this state based on the bounds you have on the value of that state. It's not how many times you came to that state, but how much is the value varying the last 3 times you came. Here is a state, the last 3 times you came, its value is solidly 5. Okay? Here is another state, the last 3 times you came, one time it's minus 1000, another time it's plus 2000, the third time it is 10,000. So this guy is obviously catatonic. We need to figure out what he really is. This guy seems to be more stable, so we don't need to do any more exploration there. That's having bounds on the values. Okay? We'll stop here. Next class, we'll come back, talk a little bit more about Q learning, and then mostly talk about generalization in reinforcement learning. Yes?
So
what do we do in our papers? That's a good question. I'm supposed to send you a sort of a feedback sheet, then that will ask questions on that. Basically, one of my issues is whether or not we're going to use the class time to present or not, and it's up to you. Okay, if you want to use the class time to present, then it's good for me or bad for me, it doesn't matter. I mean, depending on, I don't have to teach in those classes. The other possibility is that we try to find Friday meetings where people present. But I will ask this question as a feedback questionnaire. And then based on that, I'll tell you when.
Okay, so I changed my mind. That first email I sent you a long time ago, forget about that.
Okay. You know what you want to do now.
I don't know, but I got a close idea. I need to stick closer with the
material. Okay.
Okay.
Okay.